Hello and welcome to this special series from Great British Brands in association with Changemakers. It's a collection of conversations with outstanding guests where we seek the answer to a very big question: what next? And in the course of answering this, we explore what it takes to be a great British brand and the people and stories behind them. Now, my guest today is Emma Rice, head winemaker at Hattingley Valley, which is a wonderful English sparkling wine brand. Not only that, it's a best-in-class winner of more than 79 medals and 13 trophies. And this Hampshire-based business is recognised for its innovative, dynamic and eco-friendly approach to winemaking, exporting its products to 16 countries around the world. Emma has been with the company from the beginning, joining founder and owner Simon Robertson in fulfilling his lifelong dream of winemaking back in 2008. And of the brand, she simply says this, that it is quintessentially English countryside vibrancy. To tell us more, Emma, welcome to Changemakers. Tell us a little bit more about countryside vibrancy.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me on. The countryside, the Hampshire Downs are quintessentially English. You just stand at the top of the vineyard looking out over the green rolling hills with the watercress line chuffing away in the distance and, you know, the spires of the village churches sort of poking up into the sky. And we're standing on solid chalk, which is exactly the same soil they have in Champagne in the Côte de Blanc. And we're growing fantastic Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, 30 minutes from where I grew up.
But it's an amazing story in some respects, just the sheer arrival and triumph of British wine, and especially sparkling wine, when you consider that just a few short decades ago, when the Californians arrived, I believe, in the late 80s, to actually basically take advantage of exactly what you've just said, chalk, and the exact requirements of making fine wines. But what a story since. I mean, if you were to bring it together as a winemaker in terms of making the case for British wine, give us the pitch. Give us what's special about it.
Well, I'd say, well, for me personally, the chance to be making wine. I mean, I went to college and did my degree in winemaking, viticulture and enology, and I never imagined that I would be working at home, essentially. I worked in California, I worked in Australia and New Zealand, and I imagined my life would be overseas. But I came back to regroup, to work out where I was going to go next, and I happened to meet Simon. And there, you know, we had this dream of building a winery, planting the vineyard, and coming up with what was going to be a relatively small operation at the time. But it's just gone from strength to strength. And I hate to say it, but unfortunately, climate change has served us quite well, in that it's allowed us to grow these grapes that we were never able to grow before and get them ripe enough to make really, really high quality sparkling wine. And dare I say it, it's almost too warm in Champagne and California and some parts of Australia to do that anymore. So we are the new frontier. Let's hope we're not the final frontier, but we are the new frontier.
But I mean, you mentioned, you know, climate change, and I mean, I suppose for the world, that's a sort of backhanded sort of compliment for the UK. But I mean, you do put a lot of stock in terms of being eco-friendly. You've described David Attenborough as your great British hero. So presumably, that's not a situation that you're entirely comfortable with, that actually British wine is that byproduct of global warming.
No, it's not. I'm not comfortable with it. And it certainly gives me some cause for concern that we are at that point where we can grow these grapes and make these wines in England. It is worrying. But I suppose if you're going to look for the silver lining and look for how humans innovate and how they sort of work with the conditions that they have and adapt and change, it's a fairly long-term prospect with wine, because it takes years for the product to get out onto the market. But we do our best. We've got solar power in the winery. We have very, very modern aerobic digesting system for the winery waste. We use lightweight bottles, as lightweight as you can with sparkling. We do all we can to minimise all the interventions in the vineyard, and you know, we recycle where we can. But there is no getting away from it. Overall, the country and the world is warming slightly, and wine is a real marker of that. There's no getting away from it. It's the proof.
Mm. I mean, when you think about what we're here to talk about, great British brands, and I guess what's next for them, When you look at the arrival of British wine as this kind of new kid on the block, I mean, the newest of the new wines, I guess, in some respects, obviously you think about other countries, a lot of European countries, a lot of new world wine countries, and you get a sense of what they're famous for. When you look at Britain and our provenance, and you look at the British wine scene, if you were to sort of summarize that in terms of what makes it notable and what makes it distinctive, what would you put your finger on?
Well, I didn't start in the wine production industry. I started in the wine trade. And if you look at the wine business in England as a whole, in Britain as a whole, from the trade through to retail, restaurants and everything, the UK market is quite unique in the world because we get wines, we import wines from everywhere. So the standards that are high for us making wine here, people aren't going to buy our wine just because it's local, just because they're patriotic. It's got to stand up to champagne. It's got to stand up to those other sparkling wines from around the world because people, they've got so much choice on the supermarket shelf. Even or let alone the other merchant, the independent merchant. So we have it forces us to really concentrate on quality.
But I suppose there must be an identity because I mean I was looking at Hattingley Valley box, and it's because it's got a very contemporary take of the Union Jack around the sort of the black box. I mean it looks stunning, but in terms of the message it's providing, what do you think the message is about British wine to those that would drink it and consume it?
That is difficult. You have to deal differently according to which market you're working in. So if you're exporting to the US or Australia, countries like that, which have a sort of a British heritage, if you like, they're really attracted to that branding, so they're really attracted to the idea of it being British. We have to be a bit more careful in the UK because the Union Jack flag unfortunately has connotations, and people are often shy of using it in their branding. But we are proud to be British. We are proud that we're doing it.
So even in a country like America and Australia, which have got very proud winemaking traditions now, seen as great innovators in what they do, when they see that kind of British identity in wine, they go for it, do they?
They do. I think in the US particularly, it's seen as a mark of quality. It really is. That the idea of it being British goes along with all the other brands that that are out there and selling well. In Australia, I think one of very well, good way of summing it up was our importer, one of our importers there. He summed it up by saying, you've got to market yourselves as British in Australia, not English, because the British are our cousins. That's where our parents came from. Mm. Whereas the English are the bastards who beat us at cricket and rugby. So, you know, you've got to differentiate. You're very much British in those markets. And when we're back here in Britain, we're English.
But it's such a thing about identity, isn't it? I mean, you know, we've mentioned Australia and we've mentioned America and I suppose mainly California. But I mean, I'm also thinking about France and its relationship with British wine and especially sparkling wine. I mean, I always think about an essay I wrote for Great British Brands last year where the estimate was that Churchill consumed around about 42,000 bottles of Paul Roger in his time. And the suggestion I made was that if he was born today, he'd probably be a great fan of English sparkling wine. I mean, in terms of that kind of cordial, in terms of the relationship with the French sparkling champagne producers, I mean, what do they make of this arrivist in British sparkling wine?
Well, I spend a bit of time in Champagne. Well, normal circumstances, not this year, but I do go there quite often, and half of the Champagne, well, I've never even heard of English sparkling wine. You know, it doesn't even cross their radar. But then again, for you know, the more outward facing companies who do have operations elsewhere in the world, they are very much aware of it, and in fact have bought land in the UK and are growing grapes. And in fact, we make wine for one of the Champagne houses in this country. But yeah, I'm not sure that the French are going to be importing English sparkling wine wholesale anytime soon. And, you know, one thing that's quite obvious with some of our customers is that, you know, they love our branding. They occasionally buy a bottle, but they often caveat their orders, their email orders with that saying, I wouldn't normally buy British. I'd normally only ever drink, you know, Moet.
But I suppose the thing is that you can't you can't negate or discount just how powerful the arrival of British wine, sparkling wine especially, has been in terms of the new brands. I mean, you are one of those sort of outliers, Hattingley Valley. And I suppose with that sort of disruption, the question is, well, first of all, how do you think you square up in taste compared to those great champagne houses? I mean, do you think that feedback is fair in terms of, you know, I would normally buy champagne, but and secondly, is the disruption more than just the benefit of this change in climate? Are there production differences, do you think, that actually give you an edge?
Definitely. The one thing I'd say, one of the key things is Plumpton College in Sussex. It started to do winemaking, proper professional winemaking courses, full degree level winemaking and vine growing courses a couple of decades ago. And I was one of the very first graduates of that. And the graduates of that course are now working all over the world. And I went to work in California, Australia, came back with huge knowledge compared to what the industry used to be. And I'd say that it's the standard of the winemaking is much better. The quality of the equipment, the investment, and this focus on, right, we're going to concentrate on what we're really good at, this sort of icon wine. It's a signature style for England, which is classic, traditional method, bottle fermented, sparkling wine is what we are really, really good at doing in this country. And we've got to get that right. Yeah.
Is there a similar journey here between the Americans in California and the kind of Paris medal moment for I think it was Stag's Leap that was the winner. And this sort of like sudden moment of realization that the kind of older wine regions around the world didn't have it all. I mean, has Britain now got its place in the sun in terms of its footing in the global wine market, do you think?
I think so. I mean, it's difficult when you're inside it, and I'm so heavily involved in it. It's difficult sometimes to sort of take a step back and look at it objectively. But I'd say the competitions we win, the champagnes that we beat in those competitions, which are always tasted blind, just the quality of the wine that we are producing is without a doubt on a level with a lot of those really high-end champagnes. And we're only just starting. I mean, we only started 10 years ago. Our first vintage was 2010. So we're babies, really.
I mean, you've racked up, I'm just looking here, 79 medals, 13 trophies. I mean, that must feel fantastic when you're beating many of the more established wine names and houses in terms of being recognised for excellence in that way.
It's amazing. The feeling is just almost indescribable when you get recognition from the international wine trade, press, and the trade itself. It's almost, I'd lost for words sometimes.
Mm. And I suppose that's the backstory. But when you look to the future and you're facing the question that we're answering today in terms of what's next, is it more of the same? I mean, will we just see ever more brands of English sparkling, or will we see distinction in other areas in the same way? Will it be a sort of a greater pack of winners as the years go by? And I suppose also, how do you see this industry changing and evolving in the years to come?
Well, one thing that was possible in the last couple of years, particularly in 2020, was the ripeness that we saw and the ability to look at making still wine as well. And I'm not talking the Bacchus variety, which we've always been very good at growing in this country, but really, really high-end Chardonnay, barrel-fermented Chardonnays, Pinot Noir, red wines, some fantastic rosés coming out of still wines. So that's also happening, and that's mainly to do with vineyard practices and how we're adjusting where we're growing certain varieties and making best use of, you know, specific sites, and also the partly the climate, but also the the location in the country. Essex, believe it or not, is the new frontier in growing grapes in England. And I bought a lot of.
Well, I was reading about Yorkshire Vineyard as well. I mean, it seems everybody's at it in terms of the growth. But it strikes me that there have been a series of red line issues that British wine has just smashed through. So if you go back, 80s, 90s, 2000s, the idea that British sparkling wine would be a thing was seen as far-fetched, or actually when it did come, people would say, well, it's just like mouthwash. Then all of a sudden it becomes this sort of like mark of quality. You now see, as you say, reds, whites, rosés coming. But it strikes me there is a brand challenge still, isn't there, in terms of actually being seen as being right up there as some of the world's finest. I mean, is that a fair observation, or do you think there are other factors at play?
I think that, yeah, there is a fair observation. There's definitely some people have the blinkers on and just aren't prepared to even try or give us the time of day. And our wines are not cheap because it's such a marginal climate. It's expensive to grow grapes and expensive to make wine here. So, very few wines are below £10, to be honest. And the sparkling wines, most of them are well over 20, if not around the £30 mark.
And in terms of the buyer, when they've got a choice of a champagne brand at a roughly similar price point, is that a point where you kind of top out? Because if you're at the supermarket or if you're buying on the internet, that actually, why wouldn't you go for champagne as opposed to British sparkling wine?
I guess that there are some people who will always go for the name of champagne, and the CIVC, which is the body in champagne, they spend an inordinate amount of money on promoting champagne as a brand, as well as the individual houses. I mean, their marketing budgets is made of the stuff that I can only dream of.
Tell us about the experience in COVID-19 for your business in terms of how you've traded through that and what you've learned about yourselves as part of that process.
Well, I have to say we were very worried in April, very worried, because most of our business was through restaurants and hotels and bars. And so our big distributor in London was concentrating on wholesale to the on-trade. And that completely died a death, as it did for lots of wine companies. But we were, I have to hand it to the team, and particularly my colleague Gareth, who's our commercial director. He turned the whole business on its head. We revamped the website and we went for selling direct to the consumer through the website. And he had made a very brave move back in the summer. And we launched the very first TV advert on Sky for an English winery. It cost quite a bit of money, but not as much as it would normally, because no one was advertising. No one was investing money in advertising. And my God, it paid off. We've just been rushed off our feet ever since. So this morning, before I came on to talk to you, I was packing up cases and delivering wine locally.
so you reinvented the model as a direct-to-consumer brand. In terms of what you've had to do to pivot for that, I mean, what message is different, I guess, than when you were selling via intermediaries like restaurants, hotels, and others? What has to change?
You have to find those customers through social media, which that has worked very well. The television advertising was also it generated a huge amount of coverage, and we got a difficult to exactly work out whether it's the social media or the TV advertising that really tipped it, but I think it was a combination of the two. It was just being quick on our feet and really turning it around.
But it also looks like you've got a real focus on brand and I guess the provenance of where you're from. And when you go on the website, this is a very, very smart company when you look at the way it presents itself. I mean, is that all part of the the luster, the image that you're seeking to create when with a business like this, when, you know, you've got to create, I suppose, values around Hattingley Valley in terms of how you start to create that kind of want among consumers.
Yeah, well, we've got if you look at Gareth Maxwell, our commercial director, Simon Robinson, who's the owner of Hattingley, and me, we don't, you know, we shouldn't really work together. You know, Simon's he's a very nice chap. He's a lovely guy. But he's incredibly traditional in all sorts of good ways, very conservative. Gareth is just out there. And I'm, you know, female. In theory, we shouldn't really work as a team, but it seems to work very well. And we bounce off each other and we push each other.
Mm. Well, it's funny. I wanted to, I mean, you said, well, you're female. And actually, one of the things I was reading in your lockdown list that goes with this episode is that you've just finished The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. And what struck you was the world of chess having some similarities with the world of wine in terms of very male dominated environments, and very few successful women. I mean, do you just pick up the story for us, Emma, in terms of how it feels, what you've learned and where things are going?
So yes, my first boss when I was about 19, when I indicated to him that I was interested in getting into the wine business seriously, he actually said I would make a very good secretary. And I promptly, a few weeks later, left his employment and went to work for Odbins.
How did that feel? I mean, just going back, you know, you want a career in wine, you've got a passion, you actually open up to someone and tell them, and then they come back and they completely, presumably, devastate and disappoint you. Tell us how you felt at that moment.
I felt very hurt at the time, but I had learned a lot from this chap already, and I still do. I still know him. I still get on very well with him. I didn't take it to heart because, again, it was a different era then. He was from a different era from me. And in fact, I did actually end up as a secretary to a wine merchant in London, but she was a woman. And the whole team I worked with were female. So, and I, you know, Jancis Robinson had inspired me by that point as well. So I wasn't fazed by it. In fact, it just galvanized me to go on and make my way in a less traditional way. I mean, I didn't go to university. I worked my way up from the bottom in the trade.
And then I went. What was your first sort of suspicion that you might be really good at this? I mean, especially because obviously, you know, You didn't stop at wine trading. You finished up in winemaking, which is a very specific skill. In terms of your suspicion that this might be something you could get onto, what gave you the first clue?
Well, I backpacked around New Zealand and worked on a vineyard in New Zealand, and I got, even though I was given the worst jobs of cleaning buckets, you know, picking grapes, the back breaking jobs, I really wanted to do more of that. But I came back to London. And I ended up as a secretary for a wine merchant. And I discovered actually that I've got quite a good palate for tasting. And I had a very luxurious start in the wine business. I was working for a Burgundy merchant. So I started right at the top with my tasting. It's gone downhill ever since, to be honest. The quality of the wines that I drink. Yes, it was realizing that I could taste and I could recognize wines and I could I could break down the taste and the profile.
But I'm almost thinking, so there's this kind of London Emma who's, you know, seeing where the trade is and seeing how it works and doing the wine tastings, and then there is the Emma that gets to the vineyard and sees the space and sees the vines and sees this fabulously different world than living in a city, I guess, in terms of the very experience. I mean, take us to that point in terms of Hattingley Valley, in terms of, you know, which is a reasonably large vineyard, as I understand it, in terms of what you saw, what it brought out in you creatively or inspirationally in terms of your own life.
Well, I think it's the best of both worlds. My first job when I went back to university to study winemaking, my first job in California was working in a winery's laboratory as an enologist. And I did that for a couple of years. And I really got to see the inner workings of all the wines. So taste them, then analyze them. So being able to really tie the two things together. And then being able, I think also most of winemaking is cleaning and logistics, to be honest. That is by far the most important side of it. About 5% of it is actually, you know, sitting around a table tasting and, you know, tasting barrels, etc. So it's that ability to be able to organize things and keep things clean and tidy.
And well, I just thought you were sitting there just drinking it all day. I mean, just a sort of, we're moving on in time, unfortunately, but one of the things to sort of, I wanted to ask you was, a lot of people are calling this the great moment of reset, that we're going to emerge from COVID, the COVID era, as a fundamentally different society than the one that went into it. And I suppose our relationship with wine, with food, with many of the things that perhaps we've been less mindful about in the past, are one of the things that may well change in terms of a life in balance. In terms of, as you see things moving forward and you see the future for your business, in terms of how you might give some final thoughts on what's next for Hattingley Valley and what's next for British wine, be really interested in your final thoughts on that.
Well, it's true for me. I mean, my life day to day has not changed hugely over the last year. It's just got a lot smaller. I don't do the travel that I was, and I think that that is not going to happen like it used to, which is a real shame as far as I'm concerned. But the concern I have is, what happens to the next generation of winemakers and the next generation of people working in the wine industry? You know, everything, a lot of things are done on Zoom, with meetings on online, on virtual meetings. How are those people? You know, I spent my 20s in London going around tastings as someone's dog's body, basically. But I picked up so much. I met so many people. Mm. You're not going to get that through a virtual meeting. And what about my young team in the winery, who I would, you know, I'd expect them to do a couple of years with me, and then I'd expect them to go off and work in California, Australia, New Zealand for a vintage. That travel, that, you know, drop of a hat, get on a plane and fly out and go and spend 3 months working in Australia, that's not going to happen.
So the what's next challenge might be about people rather than product.
I think, yeah, I mean, we can, you know, we can carry on growing the grapes, making the wine here, but you need people to go off and travel and come back with new ideas. You can't stand still. And I think there's a danger that we're just going to be sort of staring in the mirror and not learning those new things, and not nurturing the next generation, because they won't be able to travel. They won't be able to mix in the same way that I used to when I was in my 20s and, you know, 30s. And it's I think that's potentially a problem, is what, how do we bring the next generation of winemakers through and get them the right experience in order to carry on what we're doing.
And so the chance to finish on and up, when you look at the opportunity to do that, what would happen next if you had your way?
Oh, what, COVID notwithstanding?
Well, I mean, it's going to end, let's hope. I mean, in terms of that next generation, should there be more collective effort, do you think, around those young wine experts of the future?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I'm part of a committee of Wines of Great Britain. We're trying to look at ways to encourage that next generation and get them trained and make sure they have the opportunities that I had, that my colleagues had, if my peers had, even if it means that it's closer to home, and try and bring the world of wine to us, even if we can't actually get out to do what we did.
Thank you very much, Emma. And that's it for this edition of Changemakers with Great British Brands. And we've heard it there, in vino veritas, in wine there is truth. And thank you to my guest, Emma Rice, for helping to actually deliver some of that truth with this story of wine, of vines, and English countryside vibrancy. And for more from the innovators and creators bringing us closer to the best of Britain, join me next time for Changemakers and Great British Brands.